not be that ugly the first one.
Good afternoon, committee members, and we open the meeting of the House Committee on Land Use. We have two bills that we'll be looking at today. The first bill, House Bill 2258, we will have a work session on. And on 2162, we'll have the public hearing only, and we will not have a vote on that bill today. But there is another bill in the works. So we'll just kind of prepare ourselves and get a little information on 2162. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2258, and we'll invite Harrison Connell. Ooh, it's been 2 years since I've seen you, Harrison.
Thank you.
Would you look all right?
It's a pleasure to see you, Representative Rowley.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Harrison Connolly. I'm Deputy Legislative Counsel, drafter of this bill. And I should probably give a little background. It's probably the background on how this bill comes to you is more important than the substance of the bill in some respects. Immediately after session, our office goes through the process of editing the new laws enacted into the existing body of laws and creating a new publication of ORS. That gives us several opportunities to read chapters, but at any time when we are reading a chapter of ORS, if we find something that's unclear, ambiguous, an absolute mistake, we make a special attention note and we keep those in our office. We have a way that every time I pull up this section 92405 to amend it, I get a little notation that, hey, there's a special attention issue here. Go find the little piece of paper that documents what the special attention issue is. And so in this case, we have an issue that needed to be corrected. And we said, hey, why don't we just have Legislative Council Committee draft a bill to clean this up? So this is a substantive change. I would not call this a housekeeping change. It's substantive. But it's a technical fix. It probably is not policy oriented is the reason that we would recommend it to you and then pursue it like this. In this case, what we're dealing with is a statute 92.405 that relates to dividing land. And subsection 6 of that said that violations of this section are subject to several provisions. Well, there are two issues. One, if you look at the substance of 92.405, not all of it is intended to be subject to the sanctions. If you read, for example, subsection 4, the commissioner may furnish at cost copies of the public report. I don't believe we intend that the commissioner shall be subject to an unfair trade practice violation because of a violation of that provision. Subsection 5 just says something about the application of other provisions in the bill. So again, that provision is really not subject to the sanctions. So that's one piece of clarification. But also, if you look at the list in subsection 6 of the sanction provision that applied, essentially that first is 646.605 to 656, that still applies. We're saying that subsections 1 to 3 are subject to unlawful trade practices. It's an unlawful trade practice. But if you look at the 646.705 to 836 series, well, that's about antitrust and monopoly, and that probably doesn't apply for the most part. If you look at the 646.868, that's about distribution of motion pictures. I don't believe the division of land is really suitable for a sanction applicable to distribution of motion pictures. The next series there is about high-octane fuel, about mixing alcohol in the gasoline. Again, just can't quite see how it's connected to dividing land. So essentially that's what we're doing here is we're correcting two sorts of errors. We're being very specific about the provisions of 92.405 that are sanctionable. And we've clarified that the sanction that applies is that it is an unlawful trade practice subject to either a personal suit by an attorney or a public suit by the attorney general to remedy the situation.
Harrison. Is there any questions from the committee? Thank you, sir. Any discussion? Okay, well, anyone else wish to speak on this bill? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2258 and open a work session on House Bill 2258, and the chair would look for a motion.
Mr. Chair, we'd like to move that we move House Bill 2258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson has moved House Bill 2258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Alderman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Greenlick?
Aye.
Nolan?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Aye.
Correct.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2258
is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have a volunteer to carry? Representative Anderson, would you be so kind? Thank you very much. Representative Anderson will carry House Bill 2258.
Amazing. This would be a good time for me.
Second year.
Yeah, I understand that. But, you know, we're all a little
late. Should be noted that it was Representative Greenlick that made that comment. Okay, we're now going to open an informational meeting with a presentation from Metro, and I'd like to have David Wagner and Randy Tucker come forth, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and I'll have plenty of opportunities to talk with you this session, but today I'm here mainly to do two things, to introduce our Council President, David Bragdon, and to play Carol Merrill over here with the PowerPoint projector. So I'll turn it over to David.
Thank you, Randy. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Biden.
Appreciate the chance to be here.
Thanks for having me.
And understanding was that you'd like to have a little presentation about some of our activities in the metropolitan region, as well as an opening discussion on some of the issues in the legislative package that Mr. Tucker has been delegated to work with.
Those that represent the Metro District, I suspect you are quite familiar. But for those committee members that are serving on this committee for the first time or are from outside the Metro area, we appreciate your coming today and educating us as to the mysteries of Metro.
Great. Well, with your permission, then I'll turn to the presentation. Would that be
very good, sir?
Well, Metro Council's existence is a recognition that a lot of the challenges in a metropolitan area don't stop at the conventional city and county lines and require regional cooperation to solve. And whether it's the transportation system or labor market, clean air and clean water, all those things cross those boundaries. The voters created our agency in 1979 to deal with those issues. We now have 25 different cities in our region, the most recent being Damascus, just incorporated in November of 2004, the largest of which is Portland. We've just undergone a strategic planning exercise to kind of identify what the major issues are that we're working on, and we've lumped into four major categories. The first is to create and maintain great places for people to work and live in the region. We do that through a lot of the land use planning efforts in terms of how areas develop, town centers and corridors. We work very closely with the local governments in our region in terms of those planning efforts. We also ourselves provide parks and open spaces through a bond measure that our voters pass. Another of our major objectives is the economic vitality of the metropolitan area, and we work to spread those benefits across the region as well. There are a couple of elements of our work that really do relate directly to economic vitality, one being the transportation infrastructure that gives people access to jobs and the ability to get around, as well as freight moving to and from industrial areas, both internationally and domestically. We also operate regional facilities such as the Portland Expo Center and the Oregon Convention Center and the Performing Arts Center to build up the tourism industry. The third of our objectives is maintaining the environmental health of the metropolitan region. We manage the solid waste and recycling system in partnership with local private sector contractors who manage the landfill and the transportation, as well as the solid waste transfer stations. We also encourage recycling through a recycling hotline. I also mentioned the outdoor recreational sites and natural areas that we maintain through an urban park system authorized by a ballot measure back in 1995. The first thing that we're working on is just improving our own internal operations, our own fiscal soundness, and the efficiency of the governments in our region. We do that in cooperation with the local governments, making sure we're not duplicating what they do, but that we add value to what it is that they do. And in terms of our own budget, over half of that comes from user fees, people paying us to provide services directly to them, whether it's handling solid waste or admissions at the zoo or room rental at the convention center. So over half of our budget does come from those sorts of enterprise activities. With regard to the activities that your committee is most interested in, the land use planning for our area, managing the urban growth boundaries, probably the most visible thing that we do, but we also assist local governments in their development of concept plans for new areas that are brought into the urban growth boundary, and in terms of helping them in that regard. We've also launched a program recently to spur investments in some of the centers, and we're working with the development industry and local officials on that to encourage development in parts of the region, highlighting successful projects around. I wanted to focus a little bit on the urban growth boundary itself. As I said, that's the most visible and controversial things that we do. We're required by state statute to have a 20-year supply of land for future development inside the boundary and to review that every 5 years and, if necessary, expand the boundary to meet the requirements that we project. We're the only jurisdiction in the state that is subject to that 5-year timetable. It's a very complicated and sophisticated technical sort of undertaking. The most recent rounds of this were completed in December of 2002, when we added about 18,600 acres. A lot of that was for residential, but some of it also for employment purposes. That's indicated on the map here. That was the largest acreage increase in the history of our agency. Also on this map is the second and smaller installment that we did in June of 2004, which added 1,940 acres to the boundary, and that is specifically for industrial uses, for economic purposes, and those are in green, those are the smaller areas. Moving forward, we have several challenges that we're working on. We're working in cooperation with the State Land Conservation and Development Commission and their department on some of these issues, and look forward to working with you as well. One of the things is that the process that we use to expand the urban growth boundary itself, something that gets more and more contentious each time, and we've identified several different trends that show that just starting the process over and doing it the way we've been doing it's probably not the most valuable way to do it, both either for the public that we're serving or for our partners in local government. One of those challenges in particular is how we integrate what we're doing with land supply management with economic development to make sure that we can make decisions about land supply that do relate to market factors and that relate to the industries that are likely to be in our region in the future, rather than just looking backwards at past trends. There's a lot of changes, of course, in the economy in our region, and so we're very conscious of the need to update what we're doing and make sure that we're doing it consistently with economic development strategies that actually help to create jobs in the region. That also relates to another issue that came up a lot, and it will come up increasingly, and that is the impact that we have on neighboring communities, as well as vice versa. on those two-way streets around the region. We recognize that our sphere of influence really does extend beyond our own boundaries, and there are decisions that we make that affect people who are outside of our jurisdictions. And we have a map that we're distributing here that will show you, based on the transportation commute patterns around the region, just how far that sphere of influence goes, even just on the basis of daily commuting patterns, whether it's down to Newburgh or up to Columbia City. So we're working with ODOT and the other agencies, as well as our sister jurisdictions nearby, to have a longer-term discussion on what those impacts are in terms of transportation, as well as in terms of management of our urban growth boundary and the urban growth boundary of jurisdictions that are near us. One of the examples that was probably the most heated in discussion last year was the discussion of industrial land south of Wilsonville, south of the Willamette River, and the impacts that that would have on Marion County. We had some discussions with them, following which we decided not to expand the urban growth boundary south of Wilsonville, but that will be an issue that comes up again, and it's going to require more dialogue with our neighbors to the south and vice versa. You're also familiar with the situation in North Plains, which is a similar situation. North Plains has just expanded its own UGB, and there are differing visions there in terms of how they grow toward us and what the interaction is. So both of those examples and others have been behind a conversation that's been going on in our region about hard edges, and so whether a concept meaning whether there's any ultimate limit to where that line might be drawn in one direction or another, and related to that too are other tools, some of which are in law currently, such as urban reserves or concepts such as rural reserves, that would provide a little more orderly direction in how the area grows. One of the issues tied into all of that too is farming's role in the economy. The metropolitan region does have a vibrant agricultural sector with a lot of proximity to the urban areas. The current state statutes designate an agricultural hierarchy in terms of where urban growth boundaries get expanded, but as the area's population grows and land is consumed, those conflicts become more rather than less. One of the things we do hear from our neighbors in the agricultural industry is that it's not enough to simply protect farmland, but that the actual practices of farming also need to be protected, and that often those do conflict with urban uses. And so trying to protect that industry is not just a matter of protecting particular soils or soil types, it's a matter of protecting the economy that makes it work. Bottom line with all of those issues, whether it's our relationship with our neighbors or how we connect our planning efforts to transportation investment or whether it's how we understand market factors, really do all relate to the process that we use under state law to evaluate and to expand the urban growth boundary. As I've just indicated, we're looking at new ways of doing that type of business, and we are, of course, governed, regulated by the state statute and rules that enable that to happen. But since the most recent passage of significant changes in that law in 1995, the process really has gotten a lot more complicated, while at the same time the economy, of course, has gotten more complex, and some of the neighboring issues have become even more vexing. The decisions we made in 2002 and 2004 were acknowledged by the Land Conservation and Development Commission for generally favorable. There were some items that they requested that we fix, but by and large, we were acknowledged and upheld through all of those processes, which is an acknowledgement that we are doing it right according to the rules that we have in front of us today. But I think all of us who participate in it wonder sometimes whether just doing it right according to those numbers games that we have is really the best contribution that we can make to the region, whether it's for great places to live or economic opportunities for the future. For example, the ability to predict the future gets harder rather than looking backwards, that we need to be looking forwards more and be thinking about what are those industries of the future rather than basing decisions on just on trends in the past. And so developing our understanding of that, I think, will be helpful. Similarly, we want to work with the state government as they review the land use system as a whole, something that the governor and Mr. Shetterly have talked about and I know have discussed with you. And we want to be undertaking that type of review as well. With that in mind, one of the things that we're asking in our legislative package is to have a minute or two to step off what we call the UGB treadmill, which is that requirement that we're almost continually in a review of the urban growth boundary according to these rules that were developed in the mid-1990s. As I mentioned, it's a requirement that only applies to us, and in practice it means really that as soon as we finish one UGB expansion, we have to start the whole public process and analysis all over again. It's an enormous undertaking in terms of the public's time and attention, and we want to get things done in a timely and thorough fashion. But we don't want to just simply remain on this treadmill. I think we want to take a minute and look at some of the larger pictures as well. The 30-year review that Mr. Shetterly and Governor Kulongoski have proposed and the passage of Measure 37 are also things that we think need to help provide backing for extending that 5-year cycle so that we can, rather than cranking up our UGB number crunching machine again, that we might be able to take a pause and participate in some of those larger efforts, whether it's the uncertainty surrounding Measure 37 or the new directions coming out of this legislative session and the LCDC. So finally, that does touch on our major issues that we'd like to be talking with you about in this session of the Legislative Assembly, extending that review cycle in terms of our urban growth boundary, participating on the behalf of the metropolitan region in that comprehensive statewide land use review, and then several other items that Mr. Tucker is talking about with regard to transportation and some of the other development-related issues. So I appreciate the chance to make these introductory comments. We'll be happy to discuss them further or respond to questions if you have them.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Questions from the committee?
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I knew you'd have one.
I have two.
As you know, my district comprises 51% unincorporated Washington County, many of those folks inside the urban growth boundary, and there's a lot of discussion about their future. Sometimes that discussion is punctuated by somebody saying, well, that was a metro decision or a metro requirement, and sometimes it was something else. I wonder if you could clarify basically metro's interest in assuring people that live in urban growth boundary areas that they get into a city, and also if I think there's a metro stake in that, and if there's, I'd like to know what it is. And also, there is a rule that allows, a rule, a statute, or something that allows a city to veto another city within 3 miles of its limit. And I wonder if that has anything to do with something metro is interested in, or if that's an independent issue.
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenway. We do look at that in terms of service delivery. We have 25 cities in our jurisdiction, as I mentioned, but we also do have large proportions of the population currently living in unincorporated areas who receive their urban services from special districts in terms of fire protection or in county governments in terms of their police protection. When it comes to particular cases of annexation or some of the very lively discussions going on right now among jurisdictions, we tend not to take sides, but to try to facilitate some of the discussions, for example, in the Happy Valley, Milwaukee situation right now that's going on. Both ourselves and Commissioner Traeger of Clackamas County have tried to convene the parties so that that it's done in an orderly way. I think philosophically we do feel that urban services are best provided by cities, as otherwise we continue to have a patchwork where in some cases people are paying for more services than they're getting, and while other people are getting services that they're not paying for. And so having a more orderly system of apportioning those fiscal benefits and costs seems appropriate to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bragg, what services would an unincorporated area receive that the residents are not paying for?
Chair Gerard, members of the committee, some of the concerns are city services, such as in some instances it would vary in different parts of the region, but it depends on what the city provides. But it could be city streets, libraries, cultural facilities, and parks is another notable one. And I think probably representatives of the League of Oregon Cities would be able to itemize that for you. It's often hard to quantify. Since sometimes these are services where the usage of them is not actually tracked. The converse, too, is that there are instances where residents of a city are paying a county tax, which goes to a county-wide law enforcement, a sheriff's operation, a portion of which is jails, which is understandably a responsibility that is countywide, but then a proportion of that also going to patrol services, which are only then provided in unincorporated areas. Often those unincorporated areas pay a supplement, but then it's a matter of debate whether the supplement actually pays for the true cost or whether the residents of the city are cross-subsidizing the patrols in the unincorporated areas. So it's a patchwork. There's no hard and fast rule, but those would be some examples.
Could you tell me how big Metro is, number of people, number of planners you have, that kind of thing, just to give me a handle on?
The population of our district? Or
no, of Metro itself.
Our agency itself is about 600 FTE. We have a budget of about $280 million a year, most of which is in the solid waste arena in terms of people paying us to take the tonnage. The planning department is about 80 FTE of that 600. Most of our employees are in the operating divisions, such as the Oregon Zoo, the Exposition Recreation Commission, so planning is about 80 of the 600 FTE.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming. We appreciate the information you bring us. You indicated on the map that there's a new 18,000-acre chunk that's been added to Metro recently. What type of land is that? What classification of that land would you say?
Representative Anderson, Chair Gerard, the 18,000 acres that was added in December of 2002 primarily was for residential purposes in terms of its future use. There are areas in there that will develop as employment and industrial, commercial, retail type areas as well, but most of that was for residential demand. In terms of its classifications before it was brought into the urban growth boundary, most of it was exception land, meaning it had an exception from the agricultural or forest uses.
So it wasn't of much benefit to any agricultural use.
Well, I think actually, so that raises one of the issues is that under the classifications of the 1970s, in theory, that it would not have agricultural use. In fact, the nursery industry and ornamental landscaping type is actually very active and profitable on some areas which do not have soil types that would have been reflected as agriculturally valuable 30 years ago, but that in practice today actually are. So there are areas in that 18,000 acres where the nursery industry in particular is active. The reverse is true as well. There are areas that are classified as farm use that are not as viable as they were in the 1970s. But by and large, those are the classifications that we use.
And that type of industry would be displaced by this as we build it up into residential.
That would be correct. As those areas urbanize, those nursery operations would be displaced by urbanization.
Follow?
Has Metro any thoughts or ideas of, let me preface it by saying, when I was in the municipal government, we were trying to, within a city, trying to put nodes for people to make to drive from the perimeter of the city to the center of the city to pick up milk late at night. You'd have little nodes within the city, and it made things more convenient. And in looking at the state, it seems to me that it might be wise for Metro to be thinking about doing the same thing within the state, where instead of increasing to 18,000 acres, where you are taking some, essentially, green belt. I mean, if it's nursery, it's green belt in a sense, and converting that to more and more and more homes, instead of moving into the UGB and building up, taking those industries that are coming to the state or want to come and placing them in Wayne County and Jackson County and Umatilla County and diversifying so that it's easier for people to be right at their jobs rather than coming in from areas to the city. Looking at your transportation problems here, I don't know how you deal with it at times. It looks a little bit like Seattle. Getting more and more intense, and it would seem to me that we need to look at that in terms of the whole state and say, time to encourage a lot of these jobs to go elsewhere and industries rather than building new areas for them to site.
Yes, well, Representative Anderson, we do recognize that we're all in this together as a state, and we'd like to see prosperity spread throughout the state. We also have to respond to market demand in our own area, and as the market demands development there under the statutes, and I think as our job as public servants is to respond to that, we do try to do that in exactly the manner that you just described in terms of having those nodes developed that do provide that more of a mixture of uses. People don't have to travel as far and try to redevelop and be as efficient as we can. And I think that's starting to show some results now in our region. And if you have a chance to go to historic downtown Gresham, which 10 years ago was really withering away and is now being revitalized, there's a lot of new investment happening there. Downtown Lake Oswego has had a similar renaissance. Downtown Forest Grove has similar things underway, and so some of those efficiencies are starting to occur.
And I agree with you that we do need to look at market demand if we're going to see the economy really take off. But it seems like sometimes there's a difference of where the market demand is. We have little businesses that would like to get started in some of the rural areas around the state and can't because of the UGB rules. And instead of being able to expand those and allow people to site where they want to put their business, we're crowding more and more into the city areas. And I think there are some more problems developing from that. Thank you, though.
I think we do have a mutual interest. Certainly, you mentioned the transportation network. The Port of Portland, we do a lot of cooperative work with them, and through studying where that freight comes and goes to, without the rest of Oregon, that port really is not a very viable place. Obviously, the grain, for example, coming from eastern Oregon or lumber coming from southern Oregon is a large part of what makes the Port of Portland go. So I think people in urban areas recognize their reliance on the rest of the state, and so having it all work together is going to be very important.
Well, keep in mind that the Port of Medford is an international airport.
Going very quickly.
And we are closer in Jackson, Josephine County to the major markets than you are. And if lumber is going to go out, where's it going to go? It's going to go south, more than likely, or east. So it seems to me that that's the way we should be directing our interests. Thank you, sir.
Mr.
Pratt,
any other questions from the committee? We thank you very much. We hope we will see you again as we continue on in this session, and our congratulations on having Mr. Tucker with your organization.
Thank you. We're happy to have him. Thank you for your time.
We will close the informational hearing on Metro and open a public hearing on House Bill 2162. And again, committee, this We will not have a work session on this bill, but we will open it up because we know there's another bill coming that this perhaps will save us a little bit of groundwork at that time. So we have quite a few folks, six as a matter of fact, that wish to speak on House Bill 2162, and I'll lead off with Mr. Art Schlock from the Association of Oregon Counties.
Mr. Chair, can I ask the administrator a question while Art's coming up?
Certainly. Matter of fact, Sam, if you'd like to give a brief rundown on this and then answer Representative Greenwood's question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2162, what will essentially do is it will remove a sunset clause that was codified within previous legislation adopted in 2003, House Bill 2691, which is found in Oregon Laws 688. And that particular ordinance had a sunset clause that of January 2, 2006, and this bill seeks to delete that section, so essentially the remainder of the siting requirements and the ability to allow abandoned or diminished mill sites, and these would affect only ones that are outside the Willamette Valley and outside city limits, or diminished sites, and that's a definition of 25% of their capacity, to be able to continue this as an opportunity if this bill was passed with the sunset clause eliminated.
Oh, yes. Representative Greenman, would you ask?
Yes, Sam, the act modified, added section 1 and section 2 of the current bill, but modified section 3. My understanding is the sunset didn't apply to section 3, so that even if the sunset was in section 3, it would still be...
No, I think the hint of the ordinance is to remove section 4, which is where the sunset provision is found.
If section 4 is not removed,
oh, okay.
The sunset only relates to section 1 and section 2, not to section 3, which was also amended in the act.
I believe that, yes, I think that's correct.
Mr. Schlock, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Perhaps you could clear that question up a little bit. I will try to clear it up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Art Schlock. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to express our support for House Bill 2162, which removes the January 2nd, 2006 sunset clause applied to Sections 1 and 2 of House Bill 2614, approved in the 2003 legislative session. As you may recall, House Bill 2614 allows a county outside the Willamette Valley to authorize industrial development and related on-site sewer facilities in areas planned and zoned for industrial use, subject to applicable permit approval, building codes, and other territorial limits. In essence, what this bill does, 2614 did, was on land zoned for industrial use, it removed the building size limitation that is established by LCDC administrative rule. And it also allowed on-site package treatment plants for sewer facilities. It did not allow the connection to a public sewer, but it did allow, for instance, a package treatment plant or on-site sewer facilities. That bill, 2614, passed overwhelmingly last session, but there were some concerns about how broad this might be used, and that's the reason why the sunset was placed on the bill to start with. When the discussions were being held, the Association of Oregon Counties agreed to monitor the use of these provisions and to report back to the legislature, and we did that.
We monitored and surveyed the counties in November of 2004, and we found that actually only three sites had used this provision of state statute, and you'll see those. One in Hood River County. It was an expansion of Cardinal Glass, and it was in an area that they would not have been able to expand on, even though it was zoned for industrial development, as it was not part of the old mill site, but it was part of the property that had been owned by the previous mill proprietor. And then there are two sites, as you can see, warehouses in Umatilla County that were developed based on the provision of the bill removing the building size limitation at this point. Yes, there's only been a couple of cases where this has been used, as you can see. And I would only point a couple of factors. One, there's only about a year that we had at the end of session, because it was until January of 2004 when somebody could actually use these provisions. And secondly, LCDC did amend its administrative rule after the conclusion of the 2003 legislative session to raise the building size limitation from 10,000 square feet to 40,000 square feet. So there may have been more sites that were developed above 10,000 at this point, but we didn't record those because of the change in the administrative rule. All that being said, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, a number of counties have looked at this as an opportunity in Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon on the coast, at least to have the opportunity for additional industrial development on sites that are zoned for and have been acknowledged for industrial use. And we would ask for your support to pass House Bill 2162 and to remove the sunset clause that was placed there as we look to see how much this might be used. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Any questions from the committee? I remember when we took our interim committee on land use to Hermiston, Klamath Falls, and almost any place in eastern Oregon, this was one of the top three priorities that those people wanted to see changed along the lines of what your bill will do. So I thank you for hearing the people. Representative
Arch, could you explain to me, I'm sure everybody else understands, but what's the difference between this bill and the shovel-ready bill? When we open certain mill sites up, are there any major zoning differences?
Chair Girard, Representative Anderson, the mill bill, which was, I believe, well, I won't answer the number because I'll probably get it wrong at this point, but the mill bill basically was to look at old mill sites.
Right.
So it was limited to lands that were old mills that had, had gone away, and the land was there. It was most often it was planned and zoned for industrial use, but there was limitations in terms of redevelopment of those sites. But it had to be an old mill. 2614, as it looks at land that is planned and zoned for industrial use. So it goes beyond the mill site bill, okay? It's a little bit larger. But when you look at the limitations that was there, it basically applies to lands in eastern Oregon, southern Oregon, and the coast. The Willamette Valley was carved out, and then lands within 3 miles of a city over 15,000 people, so that there was concern about the industrial growth should go in the city, the larger industrial growth should go in the city rather than just outside the urban growth boundary at this point. So there was a lot of some consideration. It's similar, but 2614 does go a little farther.
Right. Doesn't have to be a mill site.
Right. Doesn't have to be a mill site.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Art.
Thank you very much.
And with your permission, we're going to hold on this bill and not vote on it today.
That's fine.
Okay. Harlan Booty? I think Harlan's going to tell us, committee members, just what changes in 2162 that are being proposed.
I thought he was coming to answer my question on Measure 37.
Well, maybe he'll do that too, Representative. Good afternoon, Harlan.
Good afternoon, Chair Girard, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, senior staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. I did want to offer our support for this concept. We will be bringing forward a bill. You heard reference to it earlier. We just have not introduced that legislation yet. I've talked to some of you about that. We're currently collecting sponsors, and we will be introducing that within the next few days. But we do support this bill. We support this concept, removing the sunset from, it was actually House Bill 2614 of the 2003 session that imposed the sunset. There was some merging of legislation, and I understand where the confusion lies. 2691 was the mill bill. 2691 ran into some problems after it passed and was actually signed by the governor. Someone did an analysis and realized that there were some problems with it, and those problems were addressed in 2614, as well as the information regarding rural industrial and rural commercial zones that had the sunset. So the sunset only applied to those rural industrial zones.
That was Section 3.
Right. That was in Section 3 of that legislation. Section 4 of that legislation was the sunset clause for that particular section. So the Mills bill will never sunset. That was passed forever. This bill removes the sunset on the other half of that legislation. We think that this is an economic development bill in parts of the state where it is needed the most. Chair Girard made reference to a public hearing that he was good enough to have in Hermiston over the summer, where he heard this situation where it's being implemented on the ground. And what you have in Hermiston and around the city of Hermiston is an area on Highway 395 where you have significant amount of employment lands, both industrial and commercial lands, that sit outside of urban growth boundaries. But this is the job space for that community. And that area has developed this community development pattern over the years, and that was fine when the comprehensive plan was acknowledged back in the early 80s. The problem occurred in 1986 when the Supreme Court issued its Curry County decision and said that this type of development could violate Goal 14, the statewide planning goal that deals with urbanization. What our bill did last session was say that when LCDC is dealing with this issue in periodic review, they're not supposed to be imposing building size limitations on these lands. You can imagine the effect of the imposition of these building size limits on the community. In the Hermiston case, something like 85% of the buildings already on the ground would have become non-conforming. That would have meant a lot of problems down the road for this community. So our bill that you will see coming forward incorporates this removal of the sunset, and will also do a few other things, such as expand the scope of the bill to include rural commercial areas. We see commercial and industrial as employment lands, and they all provide jobs, and these communities need the flexibility to allow for those jobs. And again, all that we're doing here is we're giving authority to county commissioners to allow uses that they've already planned and zoned for. You know, these areas have been zoned for this use for many years. And all that we're saying is that these areas would in effect be grandfathered in that the buildings that could go onto these areas would not be subject to arbitrarily created building size limits. So we look at this as an...
Your bill will only deal with existing zone property, not with future.
Chair Girard, Representative Greenland, that is correct. Our bill will only deal with areas that were zoned and planned for rural industrial, rural commercial uses on, I believe, January 1st of 2004. It's a grandfathering bill. It says that those areas that had that zoning in place will now not be subject to building size limits imposed upon the community by planners at the DLCD. We think it's a jobs bill. We think it returns some local control to county commissioners. And again, the limitations are pretty significant. We're talking about areas that are outside of the Willamette Valley. We're talking about areas that are outside Oregon's larger cities by at least 3 miles. And in addition to that, we have a safety valve built into the bill that allows for requires the counties to negotiate, to give notice and then to negotiate with any cities within 10 miles of these planned uses. So we think that, you know, this is a very reasonable land use reform that will provide economic development in areas where it is needed the most. With that, I will conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll bring forth the director of the LCD, Mr. Shetterly, and Bob Wendy. Would you like to come up at the same time?
I'll do it.
Oh, okay. The boss says he will handle it. That's it. Good afternoon, Wayne.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Wayne Shetterly, director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. My purpose here, as much as anything, is to highlight to you an effort that is underway through the department under the direction of the commission, and that is to get at very much the same issue that this bill addresses, and without having it in front of us, even the bill that Harlan Levy referred to as Representative Anderson recalled when I was here before. He remembered the trip that I came down to Cave Junction for a lunch meeting with some of his constituents and heard from several of them about their concerns about this issue of rural, industrial, and commercial lands and the restrictions on that development that currently exists under the Curry County case and the rules that have been adopted to implement that Curry County decision. I made the commitment at that meeting, as I had at previous meetings, that this was an issue that we were aware of and were going to take action on within a month of that meeting. The commission, in fact, directed the department at my request to bring together a work group to address not only the industrial but also commercial issues on rural lands and do it in the context of the full range of issues under the land use planning system. So our purpose here, in appearing on this bill, would be to say that to the point that you come to address this at a work session, our request would be that rather than remove the sunset, you extend the sunset. That would allow any current or imminent development opportunities to go forward unimpeded by an inadvertent repeal of this sunset, but at the same time would also allow the commission and the department to do the work to which we have committed and which we have undertaken in addressing this with our work group and again in context of the full land use planning program. That's basically it. We think that, again, we are by no means opposed to the intent and purpose behind the counties here in fostering economic development in rural parts of the state. We think that's an important economic development objective. We would have started the work and would appreciate the opportunity to continue that with the work group that we have actually underway. Mr. Levy is a member of it. Mr. Schlack is a member of that work group, and we are committed to seeing that work through. An extension of the sunset to next session would allow that to happen and still give the legislature time then to remove the sunset if for some reason that effort should fail. But we really do want to demonstrate our good faith in getting this work done.
Wayne, have you seen LC 1540, which is now the son of 2162?
I saw it, I think Harlan gave it to me last Friday.
Have you had a chance to see whether your position would remain the same in regards to that?
My sense is only in that the work group that we have put together has been directed to address both industrial and commercial. I guess my request on that, again, would be that we allow the departments and the commission's work group to conclude its work or take its best shot at this before imposing a legislative fix on this. We think we can do it, and again, we have the right people at the table to get it done, but ours will include both commercial as well as industrial.
Any questions, Mr. Shirley? Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Stephen Cavori. I see Schlack and Levy were both for this bill. Shirley and Wendy both indicated halfway in between. But, Stephen, now you're on the other side. You are flat out against this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here representing the Reading Chapter of the American Planning Association. Life will be awfully dull if everybody from my funeral agreed with me, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely, Mr. Cafori.
I just want to let the committee know that we are in support of the position taken by the Department of Land Use, Land Development Conservation. I am also a member of the work group that Lane was just telling you about. There are some really interesting and highly technical issues that we're in the middle of discussing. It's an educational episode for me. These are people know a lot more about than I do, but I still think that there's some important, not only the technical issues, but some important philosophical questions here about what we want, how we want our land use planning system to work,
Steve,
design, and where it is.
Eastern Oregon's tired of waiting.
Oh, I understand that, Mr. Chair.
How much longer would your work group, what date would your work group have your position in this regard?
Mr. Chair, I understand we're due to finish up in a couple of months. We're not looking at this in 2 or 3 years.
Excuse the interruption.
No, that's fine. That's a good question to ask. I just want to add a couple of things. It was interesting to me last session, Representative Smith and Senator Metzger brought the new bill in because of a situation in their community. And their concern was that doing an exception process through the existing law would be too expensive and take too much money. And as I understand the situation, the last company went both ways. They went the exception route and with the legislative route both because they didn't know which one was going to make it. And it turned out that the exception was granted before the legislation became enacted. So sometimes we despair at administrative agencies acting with celerity. But actually, LCDC can act quickly, and a lot of the things that need to be done under this bill can be done administratively by amending Bill 14, if that's the decision that needs to be made, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Mr. Gifford?
Well, you got off, too.
Thank you, Stephen. And finally, our last speaker on this measure is Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon City.
Mr. Linda. We also have a representative, I see, of the Thousand Friends of Oregon in the room, and I was wondering if they're going to have a position on this. I'm not used to having something like this here without them objecting to it.
You see, you have a role to play.
Good afternoon.
Oh, and you are accompanied by Mr. Riggs.
I am. I have a caboose if at the request of the chair of the committee, if that's all right. He didn't get his name on the sign-up sheet.
Very good.
Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. You've heard from prior testifiers, and what I would like to say plainly and clearly, we absolutely support House Bill 2162. We worked very hard with that group last session. There was a legislative work group that worked to craft that bill, bring consensus to all players, including 1,000 friends, and we are happy and will continue to support that bill. As well, if that sunset doesn't ultimately get lifted but extended instead, we would support that position. I'd like to throw out something to you. I'd like you to think about what that bill really symbolizes. I would throw out that the net of that problem is not necessarily increasing the uses outside of urban growth boundaries, but the solution lies with the increased flexibility in urban growth expansions. And I'm sure the committee, the interim committee, heard some testimony to that extent over the course of the interim. There's several other issues here outside of, including the complexity of the UGB expansions. We're talking about a basic planning issue, which includes service provisions, and service provisions consistent with Goal 11 transportation issues. Lastly, we're talking about a revenue issue, and the way revenue issues work here in terms of planning issues, I know it's something in the past that we haven't seen converge, but as we go into the future, we will see it more and more. Cities receive revenues from many different sources. Measure 5, as you remember, passed in 1990, and it restricted our abilities to provide local revenues for services. Additionally, we had Measure 47 and 50 passed in 96 that also restricted our revenues. Under the Measure 5 cap, cities and local governments share revenues with local service districts, cities, and counties. We had quite a bit of margin in the old days under that cap provision. But as we move forward into the future, that margin becomes less and less. And cities' ability to raise revenues, to provide infrastructure and services, both inside city limits and outside city limits and inside urban growth boundaries, is becoming less and less.
Linda, are those various taxing districts, are those compressed when it comes to the bottom line?
Yes, they are. So as we move forward in terms of looking at how we plan and how we restrict or allow uses, we also need to look at how we fund the infrastructure and the effects and impacts of infrastructure on those uses. Cities are very concerned with when we start expanding those uses outside of a narrow scope. The scope of this bill was fairly narrow last session. When we expand them to include commercial uses, even outside UGB, the impacts are greater. The impacts are greater on services, infrastructure. The impacts are greater in terms of transportation, the trip generation. So those are things that I think we really, really, really need to take into consideration. Last session and during last interim, there was quite a bit of discussion about this, and I did a survey of a lot of cities throughout the state. And let me just read a couple of the things I got back to sort of illustrate to you some of these things. Development outside UGBs is very problematic and ultimately defeats the fundamental purpose of Oregon's land use system. As you know, we have almost every development in our UGB challenged by dissident groups. And to turn around and contemplate sending that development outside UGBs put much greater strain on regional services we provide. Cities still provide parks, library, roads, and to some degree police, with absolutely no tax base outside those UGBs often. One thing that should be considered is the amount of work required on the part of any city or county to expand their UGB in areas where there is a need for additional lands. It would be helpful if cities had more flexibility to increase the urban growth boundaries, but to allow growth outside boundaries defeats the purpose and the concept of land use. What can happen over time is that these areas tend to demand services from the closest jurisdiction without paying the property taxes, i.e., these developments can get subsidized. This leads to inefficient extension or provision in the case of public safety of services and encourages expansion where these step-out commercial and industrial projects are located. bad idea. Small cities have enough problems attracting this type of development inside the UGB. To encourage it outside just makes it look like every other state. And lastly, commercial and industrial development located outside city boundaries generally costs more to service because of the inefficiencies of islands of service needs like utilities and distances from service origin like fire, police protection, and employee housing. Every commercial establishment in an unincorporated area is a consumer that doesn't pay the full cost of its services. These are very, very real issues that cities look at. One thing we also heard is that if we do expand uses outside, just outside of UGBs, allow cities first the option to annex those areas, to bring that in so that we can plan effectively for the provision of services, for the impacts on transportation with trips being generated. So those are some concerns I wanted to share with you today. Again, we very much support the bill that you see in hand. We recognize the chair's interest in this issue and would very much like the committee to recognize the political nature, the concerns around this issue, and perhaps look at either through DLCD's work group or legislative work group an expanded look see at this issue this session.
Any questions, Linda?
If the committee is interested, I do have this survey with me, and I probably have about 40 responses statewide from cities about this issue. So I can make that available.
Linda, are there any cities in the state of Oregon that do not charge system development charges?
Yes, there are. And there are different types of system development charges, and not all cities charge all types.
So we don't allow them to charge all types.
Some communities simply won't tolerate the imposition of system development charges.
Well, and I can only speak to my time as a commissioner in Klamath, but whenever anything was going to locate, if, of course, there never was anything permitted, but the county has to do work with ODOT on transportation and on other services also before anything could be located. The way you described it, it's just a tremendous burden on the cities alone, but I think the county's sharing that burden, don't they?
Agreed, Mr. Chair. Especially, Klamath Falls is a very unique city, I think, in the state, in that there is a tremendous amount of development both inside and outside city limits and inside the UGB. They've allowed that in the past. Simply because some of our cities have allowed it does not mean it's necessarily the best precedence for all cities in terms of long-term planning to follow.
Okay, good point. Mr. Riggs.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, looks like bad in cleanup. Okay. For the record, I'm Doug Riggs. I'm here today representing the Central Oregon Cities Organization. We include Redmond, Bend, Madras, Prineville, Sisters, Pumtoppin, Maupin, Notorious, and Culver. I think I got that all in correctly. We are right in the heart of Central and Eastern Oregon, as you point out, Mr. Chairman, which is an area that warrants and needs more economic growth. And we strongly supported House Bill 2614 last session as it came out of the work group. We also strongly supported the mill bill that we talked about, and we also supported Senate Bill 467, which got rolled into House Bill 2011, which included the 25 industrial sites bill, and actually we felt it should have gone quite a bit further on industrial land. So I just wanted to put that in context. COCO has been aggressive supporters of economic development in rural areas. We also, just as you may recall, had a bill that this committee passed out last session, which would have allowed cities to self-certify a need for industrial land. As you know, certification of a need takes a study, it takes time, it costs money, and it ultimately delays the ability of a city to expand its industrial areas within the UGB. Unfortunately, the bill did not pass. It passed this committee, went to the Senate, and was threatened by a veto with the governor and didn't end up passing. As I said, we are here today primarily to support the bill that the counties have come up with moving this reasonable alternative. As an alternative to that bill, if the committee wanted to extend the sunset for 2 years, I think that would be acceptable to our group as well. I did want, however, to come up here, and I had not planned to testify until I got here, because I had not seen LC 1540 or any amendment to this point. We were aware that something was being drafted. But speaking from our cities, I think that we would have some concerns with moving ahead with allowing unlimited commercial development with higher population levels than were in 2614 without at least having an opportunity to sit down in a legislative work group and have a discussion on that. And I'll go into more detail maybe at the next hearing. But you can imagine the situation in a city like Madras or Prineville, which has spent the last 10 years working to get its UGB expansion through the DLCD process. We've set aside significant areas inside of our UGB for commercial development, and we may have planned to have a retail store of some sort located within that UGB, and all of a sudden we're faced with a situation where that store might locate within 5 or 10 feet of our existing UGB and still have the same kind of a traffic impact, population impact, et cetera, that a store would have had it been inside the UGB. But of course, we have no avenue to collect property taxes or anything to pay for those services. So again, we have absolutely no problem with extending the bill as envisioned by the counties. We might be able, in a legislative work group, to work out an agreement with the various parties on commercial development. I'm not sure about that, but I just wanted to make sure that I came to the committee and let you know of our concerns ahead of time so we don't get into the situation where we have a work session with the next opportunity and no real chance to talk about the issues. So I think with that, I'll be brief and conclude and take any questions that you might have to ask. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Riggs?
Sure, I don't have a question, but on behalf of the Choo Choo Caucus, I'd like to inform.
Did you identify the Choo Choo Caucus?
The Choo Choo Caucus of the legislature. That on behalf of that caucus, that she gave Mr. Riggs an exalted and obsolete title, naming him the Caboose. And the best you can do in modern times is to name him an end of train device. Which would be
Mr. Chairman, that seems much more politically correct.
It took us a while to figure out where you were going.
No real is the answer.
Well, you could say you were following the wrong track or something.
Some of us still haven't figured it out, sir.
Do you have any further questions of either of our two guests? Thank you both. We are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2162, and we will wait until sometime in the future when the other bill is brought forth, and then the committee will have to decide between the two if we're interested in either one of them. So we will have two more bills on Wednesday, and Sam will get that information out to you, and I thank you for your attendance this afternoon. We are adjourned.
Mr. Chair.